All right, let's move on to point number three, embarrassing testimony, and this one's my favorite. By the way, none of these are decisive in themselves. You need a cumulative case. And as I say, there's more in the book, but I like this one because it's kind of fun. It's intuitive. Embarrassing testimony. Now, what is embarrassing testimony? Historians sometimes use the principle of embarrassment to discover if an author or authors are telling the truth. It goes like this. If it's embarrassing to the author or authors, it's probably true. Why would it be true? Why are you going to make up embarrassing details about yourself? In fact, if you really did something embarrassing, you probably wouldn't want to share it, right? You probably want to hide true embarrassing details. In fact, let me ask the question this way. How many people in here have ever lied to make yourself look good? If you don't have your hand up right now, you're lying to make yourself look good, and we know you're lying. It's not working. How many people in here have ever lied to make yourself look bad? You don't lie to make yourself, what are you, a pool shark? Maybe. You don't lie to make yourself look bad. You may lie to make yourself look good, but you don't lie to make yourself look bad. That's why we call this the duh factor. They would never invent so many of these embarrassing details about themselves. The New Testament writers, by the way, this is true of the Old Testament writers as well, but let's just talk about the New Testament. Notice that the New Testament writers depict themselves as dim-witted. They fail to understand what Jesus is saying several times. In fact, they don't even really get his mission until he's already risen from the dead and ascended to heaven. That's how dim-witted they are. And they are uncaring. They fall asleep on Jesus not once, but twice. Stay up with me and pray. This is my greatest hour of need. What do they wind up doing? In the Garden of Gethsemane, the night before he's going to be executed. And then they make no effort to give Jesus a proper burial. Who buries Jesus? Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. Now, who was Joseph of Arimathea? He was a member of what? The Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin sentenced Jesus to die. Why would they make Joseph look like a good guy while they ran away and hid for fear of the Jews? And why would they put Jesus in a Jewish tomb? What could the Jews have done? If the Christians had claimed Jesus had risen from the dead, but Jesus' own dead body was still in the Jews' own tomb. What could the Jews have done to squash Christianity right then and there? They could have produced the body and said, look, this guy's dead. He's in our tomb. Here's his body. In fact, even if it was a skeleton by that point, if they'd pulled a skeleton out of the tomb, it would have been enough to refute Christianity. The presumption would have been, that's Jesus' skeleton. They didn't do that at all. What did they do? They said the disciples came and stole the body while the guards were asleep. Now, that's a bad explanation for at least two reasons. Reason number one, if you're a Roman guard on duty and you fall asleep on watch, what happens to you? You're toast. Reason number two, if you're a Roman guard on duty and you fall asleep on watch, how do you know what happened? What happened? Well, we were asleep, see? And while we were sleeping and remained sleeping, we noticed that the disciples came right in here, took this body away. The third reason it makes no sense is what motive would the New Testament writers have to say that, or what motive would they have to come and steal a dead body and say it had risen from the dead? Remember, these were Jews. They thought they were God's chosen people. Why are they inventing a resurrection story to get themselves beaten, tortured, and killed? That doesn't make any sense. You say, well, how do you even know the burial story, or I should say the disciple stealing the body story is what the Jews said. Well, the Gospel of Matthew tells us this. How do you know Matthew's telling the truth? Well, it's not just Matthew who says this. There's an ongoing debate early on in Christianity, the first 100 or so years. The Christians are saying Jesus has risen from the dead. The Jews are saying the disciples came and stole the body while the guards were asleep. Now, what does that explanation imply? That the tomb was empty, right? You don't have to come up with an empty tomb story if he's still in there. You'd say, look, his body's right here. They didn't say that. They said the disciples came and stole the body. So they're admitting the data. What's the data? Empty tomb. Also, notice they are rebuked. Peter, their leader, is called Satan by Jesus. You think they made this up? You think Mark, who recorded this, said, hey, Pete, I'm going to make this a real interesting story. I'm going to have the Lord call you Satan. What do you think Peter would have said? Have him call you Satan. What's he calling me Satan for? I'm the leader here. Doesn't make any sense. And notice, Paul rebukes Peter for being wrong about a theological issue. He says, I told Peter to his face that he was wrong for trying to get the New Testament believers to obey the Old Testament law. It's Galatians chapter 2. Now, question. I was doing a radio program about a year ago. I was talking about the debate I mentioned last night between Ken Ham and Bill Nye. And as I say, I like Ken Ham. He explained some things very well in that debate, but I thought it was a missed opportunity. And so I was, and I know it's easy to be a Monday morning quarterback, don't get me wrong, but I just thought it was a missed opportunity to debate the real issue. You know, does God exist? Did Jesus rise from the dead rather than the age of the universe? I mean, you could prove the age of the universe is young, and that's still not going to convince somebody to be a Christian, right? So what? So I got an email from a concerned listener who said, you ought not be criticizing other Christians. You guys notice the self-defeating nature of this claim? What was she doing? Criticizing another Christian, right? Now, question, are we supposed to criticize another Christian? Are we not supposed to criticize other Christians? If you say no, we're not supposed to criticize other Christians, you don't believe the Bible. Here it is, right in the Bible. You've got one apostle criticizing another apostle. This guy's supposed to be the first pope, Peter, right? And here's Paul rebuking him. He's dope slapping him in the Bible. You dope, what are you doing? Now, you don't have to be unkind doing this. In fact, what is the purpose of the Bible? According to 2 Timothy, Paul's last letter, the purpose of the Bible is to make you wise unto salvation and is useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and preparing us to do good works. That's the purpose of it. How are you supposed to correct one another if you're not allowed to? You're supposed to do this. Now, again, you don't have to be unkind doing it, but we have to do it. If we're going to help one another be better disciples, we have to correct one another. In fact, what does disciple mean? It means it comes from discipline. It means a learner. You have to continually teach one another and help one another head toward Jesus. That's the whole point. So the purpose of the Bible is to make you wise unto salvation. The purpose of the Bible is not to tell you everything about everything. The purpose of the Bible is not to cover every possible issue in detail. There's no book that could. You know, a lot of times I get the question, well, what about the dinosaurs? How come the dinosaurs aren't in the Bible? For the same reason the Great Wall of China isn't in the Bible. It's not part of the scope of the document. In fact, even books on taxonomy won't tell you everything about every animal out there. The Bible is a limited book about a limited theme. What's the theme of the Bible? Redemption. You have paradise lost in Genesis, paradise regained in Revelation. Everything else is a story of redemption. It traces one bloodline through the Old Testament, the bloodline that's going to bring the Messiah, because we've fallen. Jesus actually enters the bloodstream of humanity. God enters the bloodstream of humanity in order to save itself from itself. And he makes it possible for us to be reconciled. The standard of justice has been violated, so he comes, he fulfills the standard of justice, and by trusting in him, we can be saved. That's the purpose of the Bible. It's not to tell you everything about everything. It's to make you wise unto salvation. So, notice, Paul is rebuking Peter. This is embarrassing. Also, they are cowards. Peter denies Christ three times. Poor Peter. Check this out. He's called Satan by the Lord. Then he denies Christ after saying he'll never deny him. And then he's dope slapped by Paul. This is their leader. And then the disciples run away at the crucifixion. This is like a Monty Python movie. Run away! Oh, they all run away. And who are the brave ones? The women. The women are the brave ones. Now, who wrote this down? Men. Now, what man is going to say that he was hiding for fear of the Jews while the women went down and discovered the empty tomb? Would any man in here invent that? If you were making up the New Testament story, man, would you say that you were Mr. Sissy Pants? while the women went down and discovered the empty tomb? There's no way I'd make that up. I mean, if I was making up the story, I'd write something down like this. Let's see. We marched right down there and overpowered that elite Roman guard. Yeah, that sounds good. And then we saw Jesus, who congratulated us on our great faith. And then we went and comforted the trembling women. I would never say I was Mr. Sissy Pants. And by the way, why would you never say the women were the first witnesses in that culture? Because their testimony was not considered on par with that of a man. So if you're making up the New Testament story, the resurrection story, you'd only have the men be the first witnesses. Yet all four Gospels say the women were the first witnesses. Why? Because they were, even though it was embarrassing. Actually, one lady came up to me once and she said, "I know why Jesus appeared to the women first." I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because he wanted to get the story out." I said, "That is an excellent point." I had not thought of that before. Because, ladies, when your man comes home from work, does he say much? There could have been a nuclear explosion down at the plant. He's not going to tell you, is he? You got to pry that out of him. You imagine Peter coming home that first Resurrection Sunday? He was married, right? His wife says, "Hey, honey, anything happen at work today?" "Nah, same old, same old." Wait, I heard Jesus had risen from the dead just like he claimed. Is it true? "Oh, yeah, it is. You got anything to eat around here?" Men don't say much. Also, notice they are doubters. Despite being taught several times that Jesus would rise from the dead, the disciples are doubtful when they hear of his resurrection. Not only are they doubtful when they hear of his resurrection, some are even doubtful after they see him risen. You see, this is Matthew 28:17. What happens in Matthew 28:19? What happens? Does anyone know? Nope. Thomas is in John. This is Matthew. Climactic point. It's the reason this church exists and every church exists. Yeah, the Great Commission. Jesus is giving them the Great Commission. He's standing there giving them the Great Commission. And he says, "Go, therefore, make disciples of all nations." Notice he doesn't say make believers. He says, "Make disciples of all nations, baptizing in the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen. And lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age." He's giving them the climactic. That's the last verse in the Gospel of Matthew. And as he's doing that, some guys are standing over there looking at him going, "See that guy there? Yeah. That guy over there is Jesus." "Oh, no, it can't be Jesus. He was just killed a few days ago. I saw he was killed." "No, no, I'm telling you, it's Jesus. Can't be Jesus. He was killed. I saw he was killed. The Romans killed him." "No, I'm telling you, it can't be Jesus. The spear went in his side, blood and water came out. I'm telling you, he's dead. It's Jesus. It can't be. It is. How do you know?" "The women told me." They're not making this up. There's even potentially embarrassing details about Jesus. Notice he's considered out of his mind by his own family who come to seize him and take him home. His own family thinks he's nuts. Now, you may have heard people say, "Well, you know, the New Testament writers invented Jesus to be God. They embellished it." Oh, really? Then why are they putting this kind of thing in here? Also, he's deserted by many of his followers in John chapter 6. He says, "Look, you want to follow me, you must eat my flesh and drink my blood." And many of the disciples said, "Whoa, this is a hard teaching. We can't follow this guy anymore." Hey, if I was there and he said, "Eat flesh, drink blood," I'd go, "What are you, a cannibal? I'm not following you either." And who would have made that up, "eat flesh, drink blood"? This is not a made-up story. It's not a made-up doctrine. He's not believed in by his own brothers. In John chapter 7, he says, his own brothers didn't believe in him. That's embarrassing. To have a rabbi have not of his own brothers believe in him. We learn later, however, as I mentioned, that James dies as a martyr in the city of Jerusalem, 30 years after Jesus is alleged to have risen from the dead. Now, why did James die as a martyr? We read earlier in the creed that Jesus appeared to James, and that convinced him that Jesus was God. But prior to that, James didn't think his own brother was God. Now, question, how many people in here have a brother? All right, how many people have a brother who thinks he's God? Yeah, you don't believe in him either, do you? Neither did James. He's thought to be a deceiver. He turns off Jewish believers to the point that they want to stone him. In John chapter 8, he's talking to Jews who believed in him. He gets to the point in the conversation where he says, look, if you believe in Abraham, you ought to believe in me, because I knew Abraham. And he said, and they said, wait, you're not even 50 years old. How could you know Abraham? And he said, before Abraham was born, I am. And they immediately picked up stones to stone him. Why? What's that a quote from? What's he quoting from? Yeah, he's quoting from Exodus 3:14, the burning bush. Do you remember when God appeared to Charlton Heston? Moses says to God, who should I tell the Israelites you are? And what does... He says, tell them I am sent you. What does I am mean? I am means the self-existent eternal one. The being that had no beginning, that will have no end. The being that just bees. The being that gives being to all other being, the unmoved mover, the uncreated creator, the ground of all being. That's who Jesus is claiming to be. That's why the Jews picked up stones to stone him. He's claiming to be Yahweh. It amazes me today there are people out there who say Jesus never claimed to be God, like Jehovah's Witnesses. When they come to my door, I go, come on in. Sit down. You want something to drink? They get out the watchtower material. I say, oh, before we get to the watchtower, can I just ask you two questions? Yeah, sure, go ahead. First question, I ask all unbelievers. The question is, as I mentioned last night, if Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? By the way, that's on the app. That's the question you got. That's why you got to download the app. If Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? Because it clears all the decks. It just points out, does the person have an intellectual objection, or is there something else going on here? They don't want it to be true. Second question, particularly for Jehovah's Witnesses, is this. If Jesus never claimed to be God, then why did they kill him? You get killed for saying, love your neighbor? Jesus is out giving a sermon somewhere, and he goes, so love your neighbor. And there's people in the audience going, what did you just say? Did you say, love your neighbor? We can't tolerate that. You must die. That doesn't get you killed, right? What gets you killed? Claiming to be God. Why? Because claiming to be God was blasphemy to the Jews, and it was sedition to the Romans. In fact, early on in Christianity, the Romans considered the Christians atheists. Why? Because they knew they weren't Jews, but they wouldn't bow down or worship the Roman gods or Caesar, so they figured these people must be atheists. That's why they called them atheists. So the reason Jesus was killed was precisely because he claimed to be God. It was a double whammy. Blasphemy to the Jews, sedition to the Romans. He certainly didn't get killed for skipping around saying, love your neighbor and pray for your enemies. That won't get you killed, but claiming to be God will. Also notice he's called a madman. He's called a drunkard. He's called demon-possessed. Hey, that's real flattering, don't you think? Let's point out that some people were calling the Lord demon-possessed. And he has his feet wiped with the hair of a prostitute, which easily could have been seen as a sexual advance. And oh, by the way, do you notice there are two prostitutes in Jesus' bloodline? Who are they? Rahab and Tamar. Now, do you think Luke and Matthew got together one day and said, you know what? I think we need to spice up the Messiah's bloodline a little bit. Let's put a couple of prostitutes in there. Let's put Kardashian in there, too. Let's make this really... Why would they be doing that? In fact, you know who else is in there? A lot of unsavory characters. Judah's in there. Who's Judah? He's the guy that sold Joseph into slavery. And from his bloodline comes the Messiah. You've got David in there. He's a man after God's own heart. Oh, really? He's an adulterer, a liar, and a murderer? That sounds just like after God's own heart to me. You've got Bathsheba in there. In fact, one of the writers won't even mention her name. What does he say? He says, Uriah's wife. But she's in there. Now, you don't find this kind of embarrassing detail in other ancient historical writings. Like, for example, you'll never find embarrassing details about the Pharaoh in Egyptian writings. Why? What would the Pharaoh have done to his historian if he began recording embarrassing details about the Pharaoh? Yeah, right? that guy's toast. But the Old Testament and the New Testament are filled with embarrassing details even about the heroes, which is telling us what? They're telling us the truth. They're not sanitizing or spinning this. In fact, this is true today, that we spin everything, don't we? You're in a company, you put out a press release, are you telling the whole truth, nothing but the truth? No, everything's rosy. The White House press secretary, is he telling the truth? And I don't care what administration it is, they're always dancing up there, but certainly this one, they're dancing all over the place. What color's the sky? It's green! I mean, it's so obvious. Yet, the New Testament and even the Old Testament just tells it like it is. No spin, here it is. Think about the Olympic quality sins of the heroes of the New Testament and the Old Testament. They're just, particularly the Old Testament, man, they're just littered with sinners, which shows we need a Savior, doesn't it? Also, Jesus is crucified despite the fact that anyone who's hung on a tree is under God's curse. If you're making up a Messiah to the Jews, you don't hang him on a tree. Why? Because according to the Bible, that guy's under God's curse. Well, Jesus was under God's curse. What curse? The curse of sin that we all put him under. But if you're trying to attract Jews, this is not the way to do it. Don't hang him on a tree. Now, there's more embarrassing details in the book, but you get the idea, okay? This is not an invented story. How about excruciating testimony? And we get this word excruciating, it means out of the crucifixion. And this is the argument that says that these people who were in a position to know whether Jesus had risen from the dead or not died excruciating deaths when they could have saved themselves by saying it never happened. This is a painting of Peter being crucified upside down. Now, before we look at these martyrdoms here, let's take a look at the apostles' beliefs and practices before and after the resurrection. Now, as we make this list here, this two-column chart, let's keep in mind that the early Christians were all Jews. In fact, out of all the writers of the New Testament, only one's not a Jew. Who's that? Luke. Everyone else is a Jew. They thought they were God's chosen people. They'd been God's chosen people for like 2,000 years. What motive would they have to abandon Judaism? Let's take a look. Before Jesus came, they believed in animal sacrifice. They'd been slaying lambs for hundreds of years to Yahweh. Then suddenly Jesus comes along and they don't do that anymore. They say Christ's sacrifice is enough. We don't need to slay all these lambs anymore because here's the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. All these other lambs were just symbols of the true Lamb. Here's the true Lamb. So they give up the sacrificial system virtually overnight. Before, they believed in a binding law of Moses. Afterwards, they said Christ's life has fulfilled the binding law of Moses. You know, the Old Testament, a lot of people look at the Old Testament, well, there's a lot of crazy stuff going on in the Old Testament. The Old Testament was never meant to be the ideal of all time. In fact, it even says that. God accommodated to the wicked cultures of the ancient Near East to move Israel toward the ideal. And Christ came and he fulfilled, his life fulfilled all 613 laws of the Old Testament. And now we put our trust in him. Before, they believed in strict monotheism. Afterwards, they believed in a Trinity, three persons in one divine essence. I know the Trinity is hinted at in the Old Testament, but it's much clearer in the New. Before, they believed in the Sabbath. In fact, they thought they could be stoned for not obeying the Sabbath. Afterwards, they're worshiping on Sunday, the day he rose. And Paul says in Colossians chapter 2, don't let anyone tell you have to obey any Sabbath or festival day. In fact, out of the 10 commandments, 9 of them are repeated in the New Testament. There's only one that isn't. Which one? Keep holy the Sabbath. Why? Because the Sabbath indicated rest. What do we get our rest in now? Jesus. Jesus is our rest. The Sabbath is indicating a rest. Now, I'm not saying you don't go to church. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying that the Sabbath of the Old Testament's passed away. Jesus has fulfilled it. Before, they believed in a conquering Messiah. Afterwards, they believed in a sacrificial Messiah. Yes, Jesus will conquer when he comes again, but they didn't anticipate the sacrificial Messiah, except Isaiah, who wrote about it in Isaiah 53. Before, they believed in a circumcision. Afterwards, they believed in baptism and communion. Now, what would have caused these pious Jews who thought they were God's chosen people to abandon everything on the left for everything on the right virtually overnight? What would have caused them to do this, do you think? The only thing I can think of is what psychologists call an impact event. What's an impact event? An impact event is an event so dramatic that it can change your perspective immediately and dramatically. Some impact events are so impactful that although you might not remember what you had for breakfast this morning, you'll remember what happened at an impact event even if it was 50 years ago, if you're that old. That's how dramatic they are. Now, only some of you will be able to answer this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If you can remember where you were and what you were doing November 22nd, 1963, raise your hand, please, and hold it up. Hold it up. The rest of you, look around. You see these people with their hands up? These people are very old. November 22nd, 1963 is my earliest memory. I was 2 years old in 2 days. Yes, I'm 53 years old now. I know I don't look a day over 52. In fact, when I turned 50, my wife was very encouraging. She said, "Honey, you're going to live to be 100. I said, "How do you know?" She said, "Because you look half dead already." Anyway, November 22nd, 1963 is my earliest memory. Because I was 2 years old in 2 days, I'm standing in the living room, a toddler, and my mom is on an ottoman in front of a black and white TV, weeping uncontrollably. "Mommy, what's the matter? What's the matter? They killed the president. They killed the president." President Kennedy assassinated that day. I can still see her in my mind right now when she was 26 years old. She's 77 today. But I can see her as if she were sitting right there right now when she was 26. Impact event. That's my earliest memory. I don't remember anything before that date and very little after that date. Where were you when the second plane hit the tower? So most of you are old enough to remember that, right? Where were you? You remember? I was in Charlotte, where I live. I was on the phone. I had the TV on that morning behind me, and I'd seen the first tower had been hit. I didn't know by what, and I was talking to a pastor in Charlotte. He wanted me to come to his church, speak about something. We didn't know what the topic was, and I said, "You got the TV on?" He goes, "Yeah." I said, "Something must have hit the World Trade Tower up there. I don't know what it was, maybe a Cessna or something." As we're talking, he suddenly screams into the phone. He goes, "The second tower just got hit." I turned around, I look at the TV, the second tower's on fire. I said, "Was it a Cessna?" He goes, "No, it was a big plane. It was like a United plane. It was a passenger plane. It flew right in there and exploded." I said, "You saw that?" He goes, "It was just on live TV." I said, look, let me call you back." I hung up the phone. For some reason that morning I had CNN on, the Communist News Network. And I'm not making this up. But the commentator on CNN said this: "One has to think there's some sort of navigational error here." Said, "Navigational error, you doofus. This is the clearest day in the history of the Big Apple. What do you think, pilots don't know where they're going? What do you think, Stevie Wonder's flying these planes? What are you talking about? Where are we going, man?" I said, "This is terrorism." Next day, I picked up the phone. I called that pastor back. I said, "We're going to come to your church and talk about Islam, because that's what this is related to." Now, 9/11 was 13 and a half years ago. And most of you in here, if I asked you where you were and what you were doing, you could tell me. But if I asked you where you were 13 days ago, most of you are going to go, "Let me look at my iPhone. What was I doing that day? Was I even alive? Did I get out of bed?" Why can you remember from something from 13 years ago, but not 13 days ago? No impact event 13 days ago. Do you think a resurrection would have been an impact event? Do you think if Jesus really rose from the dead, they would have remembered everything they were saying and everything they were doing and everything Jesus was saying and everything Jesus was doing till the day they died? Of course, it would have been an impact event. And that's the only way I can figure out why they would have abandoned everything on the left for everything on the right virtually overnight. I mean, why would they die for a known lie? This doesn't make any sense. In fact, here's a good question to ask. What did the New Testament writers have to gain by making up a new religion? What did they have to gain? These are Jews. They got excommunicated from the synagogue, then beaten, tortured, and killed. Last time I checked, that was not a list of perks. We're going to start a new religion. We are? Yeah, what's it going to get us? Well, first we'll get excommunicated, and then we'll get beaten, tortured, and killed. Well, sign me up! What a great idea. Why haven't we thought of this before? No, I don't think so. In fact, they had every motive to say the resurrection did not happen, not every motive to say it did. Now, I get this question a lot. Maybe you get this question a lot. People will go, are there any non-Christian writers that talk about Jesus? Well, actually, there are. That's extra-biblical testimony. It's in the book. I don't have time to go into it now, but yeah. But you know what the underlying assumption is behind the question? The underlying assumption behind the question is, you see, you can't trust these people. These people are religious. Come on, they embellished it. We know. We can only trust the secular objective writers, right? First of all, Josephus, of course, is not a secular writer. He's a Jew. But if you think about that objection long enough, you realize how stupid it is. Why? Because these people who wrote this down had everything to lose by saying it was true. And yet they said it was true anyway. If anybody's telling the truth, it's the people that wrote these documents down. Why? Because they had everything to lose by saying it was true from a temporal perspective. Not everything to gain. Why invent this? They're Jews. They had every motive to say it didn't happen. Not every motive to say it did. Why would they die for a known lie? You say, wait a minute, Frank, you just got done talking about Islam. Muslims, they have martyrs. Yet the Quran, Surah 4, verse 157, says Jesus never even died, much less rose from the dead. But the New Testament documents say he did die and rise from the dead. They both can't be true, yet they both have martyrs. So isn't the whole martyr thing kind of a wash? No, why? There's a lot of differences between the New Testament martyrs of New Testament times and the Muslim martyrs today. But let me just give you one difference for our purposes here. The Muslim martyrs don't have any evidence that Islam is true. They just have faith. The New Testament writers, on the other hand, were in a position to know whether Jesus had risen from the dead. They saw Jesus. They touched Jesus. They ate with Jesus. They verified with their own senses that Jesus had risen from the dead. You see, many people will die for a lie they think is the truth. Nobody will die for a lie they know is a lie. And the New Testament writers were in a position to know whether it's a lie or not, and they went to their deaths anyway. You can't get better evidence than that unless you were there yourself. So, the summary of this whole deal is, we have early eyewitness, embarrassing, excruciating, expected, and extra-biblical testimony. By the way, expected deals with Old Testament prophecy. And by the way, if I only had one Old Testament prophecy to hang my hat on, it would be Isaiah chapter 53. If you don't know what that is, go read it, and as you read it, you'll go, wow, this is about Jesus. Yeah, the problem is it's written 700 years in advance. So check that out, extra-biblical testimony. And then there's several others in the book, so you can get the book to learn more. The bottom line to the entire New Testament question is the New Testament's historically reliable. It's fact, not fiction. If it says Jesus said it, then Jesus really said it. If it says Jesus did it, then Jesus really did it. Now, I'm not saying that this argument proves the Bible is inerrant. You have to do a lot more work to get to that point. We do in the book. All I'm saying here is that the documents are reliable, that they give you the basic truth about what happened to Jesus, that he did die and rise from the dead. If that's the case, Christianity's true. You don't need an inerrant Bible for that. I believe the Bible's inerrant, but you don't need an inerrant Bible to know this kind of stuff. You just need historically reliable documents. Now, some people will have trouble. They'll say, well, you know, one gospel says that, you know, so-and-so got to the tomb first, and the other says this got to the tomb, they got to the tomb first, and another says there's one angel at the tomb, and another says there were two, and, you know, these are hopelessly contradictory. There's no way that these could be true. Not so. There's always, you need to realize there's a difference between a difference and a contradiction. Differences among eyewitnesses are what authenticates eyewitnesses as truly being eyewitnesses. Any judge that has eyewitnesses give word-for-word testimony on an event that's the same, including all the details, is going to say what? Collusion. They got together to get all their details straight. No eyewitness sees every detail in exactly the same way. In fact, when Jim Wallace comes here next year, he's the expert at this, the cold case homicide detective. He'll go into this in great detail. You need to be here for that. But do you know the Titanic? When the Titanic sank, some eyewitnesses said the Titanic sank whole. Other eyewitnesses said it broke in two before it went down. hopelessly contradictory. I guess the Titanic didn't sink. No, what do they all agree on? They all agree the Titanic sank. They disagree exactly how it sank, but the big deal is what? The Titanic sank. Same thing is true with the resurrection. Everybody agrees it was a resurrection. Who got to the tomb first and all that? They may disagree over that. But that doesn't mean that the thing is hopelessly contradictory and Jesus didn't rise from the dead. That's exactly what you'd expect from eyewitness testimony. Now, obviously, much more in the book on that. But the point here is that's what you would expect. So the overall argument, and again, it's in more detail in the book, does truth exist? The answer is yes. It's self-defeating to say it doesn't. Does God exist? Yes. There's good evidence that God exists. Are miracles possible? Yeah, the greatest miracles already occurred, the creation of the universe out of nothing. Is the New Testament reliable? Is it true? Yes, we just went through that. We'll get to questions again here in a couple minutes. I'm just going to wrap this thing up. So for more, the book and the DVDs are back there. Don't forget, this is the website you want to put your email address into, and we're going to email you this presentation and some other information that you're going to want to have. So type that in. We've got a lot of YouTube videos up. In fact, we probably put up a couple a week, real short videos, usually Q&A videos, which can be fun. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. Please like our Facebook page, Dr. Frank Turek, and also crossexamined.org. We don't have the personal pages because we've run up against the limit there, so you got to like us. And by the way, we're so into YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook, we've actually combined YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook into one social media platform. We call it YouTwitface. You may want to sign up for that. It's kind of a Jersey thing, okay? Don't forget radio or DirecTV and get the free app. Here is the app. There's a quick answer section on there. If you go to our website, crossexamine.org, and click on app, you can get it, or you can go to the app store. It works on just about everything, Droid, Windows, Apple, works on all platforms, all right? All right, before we get to your questions, let's just wrap up with, let's just say this whole Christianity thing is true, which it appears to be true. Okay, the question is, so what? So what if it's true? What does it matter? Okay. Well, in order to answer that, we've got to answer the question, why did Jesus come? Well, you know what? He actually answers that question for us. He tells us, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So we're supposed to be servants, and Jesus came to give his life as a ransom. Now, a lot of people are thinking, ransom? I don't need anybody to pay God a ransom to get me off the hook. I'm a pretty good person. I can make it to God on my own. I don't need anybody paying a ransom. You know why we think that? Because we have a relative moral standard in our mind. From the moral giant Mother Teresa down to the moral midget Hitler. And next to Hitler, we put criminals. We know they're not quite as bad as Hitler, but they're bad. Then next to criminals, we put all the immoral people we all know. You know, our immoral friends and relatives who aren't quite as good as we are, because our picture's right here next to Mother Teresa. And then if we believe in heaven and hell at all, we arbitrarily draw a line in the sand and we say, these are the bad people, they're going to hell, and we're the good people, we're going to heaven. That's if we believe in heaven and hell at all, right? Well, I'm here to say that, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 10, we ought not be comparing ourselves to one another. We're all sinners, we're all falling short. The line does not run up and down. The moral line does not run up and down between people. The moral line runs actually across the top. And all of us have fallen short of that perfect moral standard. We've all fallen short, from Hitler to Mother Teresa and everyone in between. God's nature is that perfect moral standard. And what Christ has come and done is he's lived the perfect life in our place. And so God can remain just and be the justifier, as Romans 3:26 says. He remains just by punishing sin. He just doesn't punish the sinner, because the sinner is covered by what Christ has done for him if he accepts that. But God won't force you into heaven against your will. If you don't want him now, that's fine. He won't force you into eternity in his presence. You make your choice. The problem is, this was not done cheaply. We were bought at a price. And this was illustrated beautifully by Third Day with cuts from the Passion. Brace yourself. The purpose of his life was to be punished in your place. His life was a gift to you. Have you received his gift? If you haven't, why not? Why wouldn't you receive it? It's free. But if you have received it, does anyone know it? Or are you an undercover Christian? If they were to drag you into a courtroom like they do in Pakistan right now and try and convict you of being a Christian, would you be convicted or would you be acquitted? Oh, there's not enough evidence here. Let this person go. If you'd be acquitted, you might want to reevaluate how you've been living. The least we can do for him after what he's done for us is at least let other people know, as imperfect as we are his ambassadors. Paul says God actually makes his appeal through you. Sometimes the only gospel people will read is you. You know, there are five gospels. They won't read the first four. So are you being the kind of person that is attractive to others for Christ? That's the question. All right. Questions?
Yeah, yes, thank you very much for being here. Yes, do you have any disagreements on, you remember Josh McDowell with Evidence That Demands a Verdict. Do you have any disagreements with any of his approach as compared to yours or vice versa?
In fact, that was one of the books that helped me bring me to faith was Evidence Demands a Verdict and More Than a Carpenter. Those are two books that I read back in the 80s that really brought me along. Oh, I love Josh. Josh is a great friend, too. He's amazing. He's, what, like 73, 74 now? He's still a youth pastor, basically. He's amazing.
Going all over the world.
Oh, yeah. He could sell ice to an Eskimo, that guy. Yeah, josh.org. Check him out there.
Yeah, these guys all work together.
And, of course, you guys saw Sean last time, right?
Yes, we did.
Yeah, Sean is an apologist in his own right. I mean, he's a PhD. He's great.
This is Fred from the Great Falls area. This is his third time down here.
All right. How far is Great Falls?
210 miles.
Not that you would know.
Just a half day's drive.
210.6 miles.
It's well worth it. Thank you for being here.
Yes, sir,
and,
thank you.
I just have to say you need to come back to Montana in the summertime and enjoy some of the beauty, and you'll see why we put up with the wintertime. So.
Yeah, it's pretty nice right now. Sun's coming out.
Yeah. Now, a question I have, we're concerned up in the Great Falls area because the city commission is being encouraged by the local newspaper there to endorse an NDO, non-discrimination ordinance. And so we're trying to get organized there and try to stand up against it. But I'm concerned that the Supreme Court, when they take this case in April, and they expect to have the ruling by June, mm-hmm. What if it becomes the law of the land? What if the Supreme Court comes out and says homosexual marriage is the way the United States of America is now going to operate? Are we going to be persecuted and shut down because we're out there saying, no, God has a right way, God has a standard, and we don't hate you guys, but we cannot endorse your vision of marriage? What should we do? What advice do you have for us?
How about them Panthers? No, yeah, we'll be persecuted. In fact, we're promised to be persecuted. I wrote a whole book on this called Correct, Not Politically Correct, How Same-Sex Marriage Hurts Everyone. First of all, let me talk about the legal question first. There is no way, logically, that the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution can guarantee a right to same-sex marriage. Here's why. When the 14th Amendment was passed in 1868, every single state in the Union considered homosexual activity a felony. There is no way. I'm not saying we need to make it a felony. Don't get me wrong. I'm simply saying at the time the amendment was passed, there is no way. They considered homosexual activity a felony. So how could it guarantee a right to same-sex marriage? That's crazy. Secondly, when that amendment was passed, women and blacks didn't have the right to vote. So if the 14th Amendment didn't give women and blacks the right to vote, how does it give the right for two of the people of the same sex to marry one another? I mean, that would be like saying the 14th Amendment gives a woman to write the right to marry another woman, but it doesn't give her the right to vote. Yeah. The very reason that women were the right to vote was recognized was because they went through the amendment process, which is why it's in there to begin with. And in 1920, they passed the law that said women have the right to vote, the amendment to the Constitution. In 1870, they passed an amendment that said blacks have the right to vote. They went through the proper process, the amendment process. If you want to change the United States Constitution, you need to go through the amendment process. You don't put it in the hands of a judge who just decides what he wants or she wants. That's not, we're not a government of the people, by the people, and for the people then. We're just a judge, an oligarchy at that point. That's the problem. Now, tactically, what do we do when this happens? I don't know what is going to happen, but to tell you the truth, the Supreme Court is not the supreme judge of what the Constitution says. There are three co-equal branches of government. So the Congress could step in and say, no, that's not the way it's going to be. Will they? No, they're all sissies. Okay? Nobody wants to take these issues on politically. So what's going to happen? We just got to love people and keep... It's going to be like abortion then. If it happens, it's going to be like abortion. We continually have to fight for what's good. Look, it's not your job to win the culture war. It's your job to be faithful.
Absolutely.
That's what your job is. You be faithful and leave the results to God. One day, ISIS may show up and murder us all. But it's our job to be faithful. We have to do what's right and leave the results to God. That's our calling. That's our job. And let me just show you one thing if I can. I don't know if I can do this here. Stand by for vectors, Victor. I'm looking for, there it is. For people who think, now, let me just point out. I mean, Dick, you were mentioning politics before. Should Christians be involved in politics is the question. Let me just show you one picture. In fact, when people say that Christians ought not be involved in politics, or anybody should, you know, certain people should not be involved in politics, I just take out my iPhone, I Google one thing, and I show them this picture. Yeah. Does anyone know what this is?
Yeah.
This is the Korean Peninsula, right? Here's South Korea, which is filled with light. It's filled with productivity. It's got freedom. It's filled with the gospel. It's one of the more Christianized countries in the world. North Korea, on the other hand, is a concentration camp. There's one major reason for the difference, and don't say electricity. There's one major reason for the difference between South and North. What's the major reason? No, it's not. No, it's not technically not the gospel. What is it? Freedom. Politics. The South has freedom. The North does not. I don't care who you are. I don't care whether you're an atheist or a Christian or anywhere in between. You ought to be involved politically. Why? If for no other reason than to maintain freedom. Because if you don't maintain freedom, you can't even preach the gospel. Can you preach the gospel in North Korea? Not legally. You can in South Korea. So if for no other reason, if you're a Christian and you think preaching the gospel is important, you better think politics are important. Because I'm telling you, if there's one issue that's going to take away your right to do that, it's same-sex marriage. You say, oh, stop being an alarmist. It's happening. It's happening already. There's a florist in Washington that's about to have her entire business and life taken from her because she wouldn't do flowers for a same-sex wedding. What? No, this is true. In New Mexico, photographer fined $7,000, wouldn't do a same-sex wedding. We're in Charlotte Monday going to have a vote on this NDO, this non-discrimination ordinance. It turns out to be reverse discrimination. Let me just say a couple things about it real quickly. Because here's what you need to say, and here's what I said on TV this past week in Charlotte. I said, I had a little debate with a transgendered person on this, and I said, this ordinance is going to force a homosexual t-shirt maker to make anti-gay marriage t-shirts if somebody asks him to do so. Because it goes both ways. It's going to force a Muslim t-shirt maker to make a gay pride t-shirt if somebody asks him to do it. And what you need to say is the government ought not be doing that. The government ought not be telling people that they have to do certain things against their conscience or against their beliefs. But that's what this ordinance does. It actually discriminates against other people. And look, if you're a Christian and you want certain t-shirts made and you go to a homosexual and he says, I don't want to do them, go to somebody else. If you're a homosexual and you go to a Christian and you want t-shirts made and the homosexual or the Christian guy doesn't agree with it, go find somebody else. Don't sue the guy and ruin his life. This is not about live and let live. This is not about tolerance. This is, you don't see it my way and we're going to hurt you. That's what's going on. And the whole reason our country's going the wrong way, it's not because of the gay agenda or the homosexuals or the liberals. You know what the problem is? The problem is the church.
Absolutely.
The problem is the church. The church doesn't stand up. And when the godly people get out of society, the whole society goes godless. We're the problem. We're not doing what we know is right. So we got to start standing up.
We have a Supreme Court that was appointed by people that we voted for.
Mm-hmm.
So it's government. By the way, we had people from Wyoming and Lincoln, Nebraska call us this last week about non-discrimination ordinances. Next question.
Yes, ma'am.
Frank, would you be gracious enough to explain a little bit more about the app and what it can do to help us?
Sure. The app, there's a quick answer section in the app. And that quick answer section, for example, has across the top, this is what the app looks like. You see it says truth, God, miracles, Bible. You know the four questions we just went through? There they are. They're just in three categories. And then the four E's. These are the four major objections to Christianity. They're in these categories. Evolution, evil, ethics, and eternity. At the church today, I'm going to be talking about this one. Okay, evil. And then if you drill down a little further, like say you drill down into eternity, here are some of the questions we have in the app. Why is Jesus the only way? What about those who've never heard? Will God send me to hell just because I don't believe in Jesus? Will people have a second chance after death? Why infinite punishment in hell for finite sins? Why won't God just annihilate people rather than punish them in hell? These are the type of questions that we have short answers to. So if you're having a conversation with somebody and they bring something up and you're not sure how to answer it, you're having lunch with them or something, you just take out your iPhone and you go to the quick answer section. And we'll have a question or a piece of evidence you can present back to the other individual. It also has all of our podcasts on there, so every radio show we do is up there. You can listen to it anytime you want. And there's other things on the app as well. So the app is just there for your use as you interact with people. You can have all this stuff right at your fingertips at all times.
Two more questions, and then...
Thanks, Frank. I'm not necessarily certain how to ask this, and mm-hmm. I might be using a bad word here, mm-hmm. but in presuppositionalism...
Yeah.
I'm just kind of curious as far as with the four questions, mm-hmm. Knowing that the fourth one is true, how does that relate to knowing that an individual, according to Scripture, is not the judge over God, or is not the judge who gets to determine, yes, truth exists, God exists, those sort of things? I'm just curious if you could speak to presuppositionalism or even define, are you using a cumulative case? Or I don't like those, that carry baggage or whatnot, but could you just speak to that?
Yeah, there's a difference between determining truth and discovering truth. We don't determine truth, we discover it. And so the approach we're taking in terms of apologetics is the classical approach. You start with, in fact, years ago, we didn't even start with truth, we started with God. But now we start with truth because some people deny truth. So we deal with, does truth exist? Because a lot of people have these objections intellectually, and they don't realize they're self-defeating. You know, there's no truth. You got your truth. I got my truth. So we deal with that first. Then we move on to the evidence that God exists. And then we go to miracles, and then ultimately the New Testament. Now, as I understand it, Christian presuppositionalism says that you can't make a case for anything without the Bible being true. I think that's false. The Bible can be false, and you can still make a case for things. What you can't do is make a case for anything unless God exists, because there is no truth unless God exists. There are no laws of logic unless God exists. There's no such thing as reason unless there's a grounding for reason, okay? So I agree that God must exist in order for us to know anything, in order for certain things to be true. But you don't need the Bible. Like, before there was ever a Bible, were there certain things true and false? Of course there were, right? I mean, Noah didn't have a Bible. In fact, the entire generation that was judged by God didn't have a Bible, but they knew certain things were true and certain things were false. God even judged the Canaanites. They didn't have a Bible. What did he judge them on? The moral law that was written on their hearts. So you don't need the Bible to show that there's truth out there. Obviously, once we show that the Bible is true, we discover it's true. It's true whether we know it or not, right? We discover it's true, then obviously we can learn a lot more about reality. But I don't agree that presuppositionalism, as some people define it, is a good way to do apologetics. And in fact, we had a debate over this in our apologetics conference in Charlotte last year. I moderated it. We had a guy who was doing the classical approach and a guy who was doing the presuppositionalist approach. And the guy who was doing the classical approach asked the presuppositionalist guy, are you telling me that I can't know anything about God unless the book of Nahum is in the Bible? Well, no, that wouldn't make any sense, right? But that's basically what the presuppositionalist person was saying. You don't have to presuppose the Bible to know truth. There has to be a God for you to know truth, but you don't have to presuppose the Bible. You know, it's possible that God exists and he's not the God of the Bible. You ever think about that? That's a logically possible position. I don't think it's the right position, but it's logically possible.
I was curious in regards to Paul. Mm-hmm. not being one of the, I've run into this discussion with people before where they say, well, Paul's books, he wasn't there, he didn't see it. So I was curious if outside of excruciatory testimony, if you had any info that backs him up even more.
Well, Paul certainly did see Jesus. He was knocked right down on the road to Damascus, and so he saw Jesus directly. And then secondly, that's why Paul kept getting verification from the other apostles. He goes and visits them, and then he says there in the creed, I received this, and I just wanted to make sure it was true when he went to meet with Peter and John and James, I believe it was. So he did witness Jesus post-resurrection because Jesus appeared to him, but then he also checked all these things out with others, and that's what Luke did, by the way. Luke wasn't an eyewitness himself, but he was an historian, and if you look at Luke is the most accurate of historians. I mean, he is unbelievably accurate. I think something like, have it in the Stealing from God book, you know, he named 32 islands, nine countries, and 54 cities or something without making a mistake or something like that. I mean, he was just incredibly meticulous. And especially when you read the book of Acts, you go, man, this guy was recording everything down to every minor detail. So Paul certainly was appeared to, as he says. While he didn't follow Jesus around like, say John or Matthew did, he was appeared to by Jesus after the resurrection.
One more question, then we'll cut it off.
Yes, sir.
Why do you do what you do?
Why do I do what I do? Well, it doesn't make me rich, I can tell you that. Well, I came to faith through apologetics, and are you wearing a Cowboys shirt? Are you a Cowboys fan? Every time the Cowboys win, it's living proof that Satan is alive and well. I'm sorry. Well, I came to faith through apologetics, and I went to school for it because I just felt a calling, if you want to call it that, that this is what I wanted to do and what I needed to do. Now, would I be in sin if I wasn't doing this? No, I could be doing something else, but I just really felt a calling to do this and was so interested in it. And for people that you know this, if you love doing what you do for a living, it's not like work. You know that. It's not like work to me. I mean, I love doing this stuff, so I guess God's behind it there somewhere, right?
Thank you so much for coming.
Hey, wait, one more thing.
Go.
Get a giant shirt, by the way. And you guys have been very helpful, very gracious for the past couple nights. Do you guys want to laugh for just a few minutes before you go? Can I show them something?
Yeah, go.
Okay. Because I want to make sure you use this material, and you'll like this. What's your name there?
Trenton.
Did I get that right? Trenton, as in New Jersey. That's why you should have a giant shirt, Trenton. It's the capital of New Jersey. You're running around with a cowboy shirt on. What's the matter with you? All right. You'll like this, Trenton. You ready? If you don't use the material here, you're going to be in a world of hurt. Because my friend... Let me see if this is it. I got to make sure I got the right standby. I'm in a different program. That's why it's taking me a while to find this stuff. If you don't use what we've taught you here today, my friend, the evangelism linebacker, will get you. All right, you better be ready for game day or he's going to get you.
Thank you so much, Frank.